This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. And so minutes after we finished the last pod and the Premier League went in two-footed on Manchester City and Leeds sacked Jesse Marsh, we'll get someone well-read and intelligent to talk us through the City story. What does it mean? Why has it taken so long? Realistically, what could the punishment be and how long will that all take? Also today, Paul Mullen's mini Harry Kane lets in Billy Sharp. Clearly not a fan of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which means Grimsby are the story of the night in the FA Cup fourth round replay with victory over Luton. We've assembled a panel of EFL experts to run us through the Championship and Leagues 1 and 2, and we'll take a look at what's going on at Southend as we try and chip away at smaller clubs with less than ideal ownership. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
From Not the Top 20 podcast, amongst other things, George Ellick, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Car Park's Ben Fisher, welcome.
Hi, Max.
And to talk us through what's happening at Manchester City from the Price of Football podcast and Football Academic. Is that a good way to introduce you, Kieran? Kieran Maguire, hello.
Morning, Max. That sounds very good to me.
Perfect. Phil says, what's an appropriate punishment for Man City and why should it be replacing Haaland with Georgios Samaras? Lots of questions like this. AM says, will the loyal Foden finally get game time in the Championship? Alan, if Man City are found guilty, should their punishment be to go back to being 90s Man City? Haaland may not fit with Pep's ideal, but I'm pretty sure he could get a tune out of Niall Quinn. And Paul says, is it time to invest in an open-top bus business now? There's going to be loads backing up once City are stripped of their trophies. The Premier League released a statement on Monday, which had lots of numbers and letters in it. I'll read a bit of it. In accordance with Premier League rule W.82.1, everyone's favourite Premier League rule. The Premier League confirms it has today referred a number of alleged breaches of the Premier League rules by Manchester City Football Club, brackets club, close brackets, to a commission under Premier League rule W.3.4. The Premier League alleges more than 100 breaches of its rules, including being accused of failing to give a true and fair view of the club's financial position, failing to include full details of player and manager remuneration, failing to comply with rules regarding financial fair play and failing to cooperate in a Premier League investigation that has concluded after more than 4 years. Man City have denied any wrongdoing. Kieran, firstly, in really simple terms, what are they accused of?
I think we can narrow it down to three things. First of all, they've been accused of artificially inflating the money coming into the club, effectively disguising money from the owner as sponsorship income. And the reason why that's important is that from a financial fair play point of view, it's income less costs gives you your profit or loss. So therefore, if you inflate your income, that helps you in the overall calculations. So this relates to some of the, I think, the early sponsorship of Manchester City and the allegation, which appears to have come through the Portuguese hacking process, was in respect of tens of millions. So that's the first issue. The second is deflating costs by having people on parallel contracts. So the one which has been quoted most frequently in the press is an allegation in respect of Roberto Mancini. He was paid a salary of £1.45 million a year from Manchester City, but he had another contract where he was a coach stroke consultant of a club in Abu Dhabi, which paid him £1.75 million for 4 days' work. Now, the Premier League are claiming, well, actually, this is a way of disguising his remuneration from Manchester City. And that, again, helps in the FFP calculations. The third allegation is that Manchester City have dragged their heels in respect of providing assistance in terms of the investigation. And they have not conducted themselves in, I think the phrase is, utmost good faith, which apparently all Premier League football clubs are supposed to conduct themselves with in all actions with both the Premier League and other clubs, which when you see some of the shithousery taking place on the pitch, might raise an eyebrow or two.
How is this different to what happened when they were accused by UEFA of broadly similar things in the case that was overturned by the Court of Arbitration for Sport?
I think there's sort of three main areas of difference. First of all, UEFA have a time bar, a statute of limitations, which says that anything more than 5 years old is inadmissible. The Premier League rules have no statute of limitations. So therefore, that's why we've seen the charge sheet go back to 2008-09. Secondly, in respect of the evidence which can be given to the Commission, and my personal favourite section of the Premier League handbook is section W80. It says, regardless of the source of the evidence, provided it is effectively reliable and relevant, it can be used by either party. So therefore, if the Premier League prosecutors decide to use some of the hacked emails, then that could form part of the evidence against Manchester City. That was that was an area which Manchester City's lawyers, by all accounts, in the UEFA case, were able to argue against. It's difficult to say how successfully. The third issue is that there really is there's little chance of an appeal if Manchester City lose the case and the commission find them guilty. Only under the most extreme circumstances would an appeal be able to take place. So it's a one-shot event that we've now got between the Premier League and the club.
City have brought in the lawyer who represented them against UEFA, the Big Sam of lawyering, Lord Panic, unless people just yelling panic around Man City, and he turned up. Apparently he charges $5,000 an hour. But what's the process now? You imagine, like, there's all these headlines, there's all these stories, we're all talking about it, every single show is calling you, and then this will go into court for years and we won't hear anything, we'll forget about it.
Well, other clubs want a quick decision because, you know, 6-4 doesn't go for Champions League places, but 5-4 goes easier. Other clubs want something sorted. Those clubs that want Manchester City kicked out of the Premier League, and there's quite a few of them, because if you think about the impact that this could have on relegation, you know, if only two go down instead of three, huge implications. Will there be potential legal cases from individual clubs who say that they have suffered as a result in terms of not qualifying for the Champions League historically? There could be a long list of issues here. But if you've got 115 charges, then presumably you need 115 defences, which even if it takes you one day to put up an individual defence, and I suspect it takes a wee bit longer, that's 23 weeks. You've got to have time for the independent commission to be put together. The KC who's in charge, he won't necessarily be sitting on the commission itself. He might just be the person that's organising it. So there's a lot of procedural issues to take place. So I think it is probably wishful thinking that we'll see something before the end of the season. Then we'll go into complete lockdown in terms of, neither party will be leaking. And that was one of the accusations made by Manchester City against UEFA, that UEFA were briefing journalists. And that's why City said, well, they stopped cooperating with UEFA because they feel that they were on the receiving end of articles appearing in the press which were anti-City. So it's likely to take months, hopefully months rather than years, because at £5,000 to £10,000 an hour, even Manchester City's pockets will be burned by some of the QCs involved.
Kieran, you spoke about possible prevarication by City last time round, and in their statement they said they were very surprised by these charges, not least because they cooperated so brilliantly with the investigation. And is there room for them to obfuscate and block and delay here?
I don't think that they will be in a position with respect to this commission. They by all means might take a long time to present the evidence, but I think the commission is unlikely to have any sympathy whatsoever if Manchester City tried to delay the process by saying we've not got the evidence, because we are talking about a case which has already taken 4 years to proceed to where it is today. So I can't see how they can possibly use delaying tactics, even though the meter is running on an hourly basis. It would not be in their interest, because if you upset the commission, then that could have repercussions when it comes to making a judgment.
Who's on that commission? Do we know?
We don't know. It's not been set up as yet.
It's not Sir Alex Ferguson, Jurgen Klopp, Daniel Levy, is it?
Well, if you go to the Manchester City message boards, that probably is very much the view taken there. I even saw on one of the Manchester City message boards somebody saying, if we are successful in this, can we sue as fans the Premier League for stress and loss of sleep? which I thought was possibly taking it a bit far.
The Man City statement, just to read it in full, says Manchester City is surprised by the issuing of these alleged breaches of the Premier League rules, particularly given the extensive engagement and vast amount of detailed materials that the EPL has been provided with. The club welcomes the review of this matter by an independent commission to impartially consider the comprehensive body of irrefutable evidence that exists in support of its position. As such, we look forward to this matter being put to rest once and for all. You mentioned, finally, Kieran, relegating City or stripping them of their titles. Are they realistic punishments if they are found guilty? Or is that impossible to answer?
I think stripping of titles is highly unlikely. In terms of precedents elsewhere for financial misfeasance, we've seen what's happened at Juventus. We saw what happened at Swindon Town many years ago, where they were denied promotion. So the potential tariffs are endless when, again, if you go to the Premier League handbook, but it's effectively finger wagging, fine, squad caps and wage caps. And then we move to points deductions and expulsion from the Premier League. Of the two, I suspect points deductions is more likely. We've seen points deductions for other clubs, mainly in the EFL, when they have had breaches of financial fair play issues. At the same time, Manchester City might be able to point to what happened at Queen's Park Rangers, who effectively used money from the owners to try to get through the financial fair play rules, and that ended up with, you know, with financial punishment. So those are the options available. Everybody will be watching this with vested interests, because Manchester City are not popular with other members of the Premier League. We saw that when, was it 8 or 9 of them wrote to the Premier League saying, hurrah, this is absolutely fantastic that Manchester City have got a 2-year ban from UEFA competition. So it's all very unpleasant, and I don't think there's many handshakes at the Christmas party.
George, maybe you know this, maybe Kieran does. Do the EFL have to accept City if they got thrown out of the Premier League?
No. I mean, Kieran will know better than me, but from the reports I'm reading, there would be no need to. Although I kind of feel like they would be mad not to. I think it might be quite good news both for the EFL and for our podcast if we suddenly had Man City playing in the Championship next season. They could move them down to League Two, which would be fun.
Wow. That would be. Then you just go, Pep, go on, Pep, stay there and do that thing that everyone says, yeah, but if you're in League Two, you wouldn't be able to do all this. That would be extraordinary. Anyway, Kieran, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll get you on again soon, but we appreciate your time as always.
Thanks, guys.
Kieran Maguire there from the Price of Football podcast with Kevin Day, which is a brilliant listen. So listen to it. Batch says, how annoyed were you Jesse Marsh got sacked after recording the previous pod? Also, if you record a pod every day, eventually will every football manager be sacked? It's a good point. Tom says, has anyone checked in on Jesse Marsh's LinkedIn? Leeds sacked Jesse Marsh. They're playing Manchester United tonight. We're going to talk about it in detail tomorrow. Apparently, they're now looking at Rayo Vallecano's coach, Andoni Areola, who Sid says is completely and utterly brilliant. They're fifth in La Liga. They like to get it forward quickly, but not get it launched. There's a subtle difference. He's worked with Bielsa before, so that's interesting. Possibly Arne Slot from Feyenoord or Ange Postecoglou. Carlos Corberan, who we'll talk about in part two, signed an extension with West Brom yesterday, so they're pleased about that. Peter says, hi, Max. Could you please avoid any spoilers for the Wrexham game, as season two hasn't aired in the UK yet? Yes, if you don't want to know the score, look away now. Wrexham lost 3-1 to Sheffield United. Oh, but Ben, they had their moment, didn't they? Paul Mullin's second penalty.
Yes, Paul Mullin has become quite the character, hasn't he, down at Wrexham? I know when they signed him, obviously had this unbelievable record at mighty Cambridge, and obviously took the plunge by... He was probably one of the first to go to Wrexham in terms of the project there, if that's the word for it. And they obviously love him to bits, and the first penalty... is just glorious, just
so good,
smacked so stupidly hard down the middle, in just divine fashion. But obviously the second one, it's not a bad penalty, but it's saved, and that's obviously the moment where, you know, if that goes in, it's a different game. in the end, a couple of late goals, Sheffield United go through. But nevertheless, obviously, a great little run for Wrexham. I do have to say, maybe I'm a bit on Billy Sharp's side in the sense that I do struggle to romanticise with the Wrexham story. I know you alluded to earlier, but obviously Billy Sharp wasn't too pleased with the Wrexham celebrations, or more so, I think, the Wrexham build-up. He alluded to them talking about already playing Tottenham or potentially what that would be like facing Tottenham in the next round. And obviously it's Sheffield United that will have that pleasure now. So, yeah, I'm probably Team Billy in the Wrexham state.
The best thing about the Billy Sharp interview was he did this two-minute interview. He went, I've got a smile on my face because we're through. And at no point did he smile at all on that. Which means Grimsby's the story of the night, George. And that is a great win over Luton, isn't it?
Amazing win for them. To get the replay, having drawn late on against Luton, seemed like an amazing achievement. But then to go and be 3-0 up at home to a Luton side who are currently in the playoffs in the Championship, who are in brilliant form, definitely the party that have come off better in the second divorce with Nathan Jones at the moment, with Rob Edwards being an incredibly popular character at the moment at Kenilworth Road. So for Grimsby to do that, it's been a difficult season for them. They started the campaign really well after their promotion back out of the National League. But there were rumours about Paul Hurst moving to Rotherham. Things took a bit of a dive. They're down in 16th now. But this FA Cup run, a trip down to the South Coast to take on Southampton, I'd say it's been a... that they're a club who've been through difficult times with their previous owner, new ownership, the returning former manager, Paul Hurst, getting them out of the National League last season and now an FA Cup run as well.
Yeah, so they do go to take on the most aggressive man in Europe, if he is still there.
Billy Sharp.
By the time the fifth round. Yeah, not, well, Billy's up there, but you know he's not self-proclaimed like Nathan Jones, is he? The FA Cup fifth round, by the way, is midweek. I don't know if it's happened before midweek. Maybe it has. February the 28th and March the 1st, those games. The other game we'll see, Fleetwood go to Burnley. Fleetwood beat Sheffield Wednesday's good result for them, and Burnley beat Ipswich with a late goal, a very late goal. I watched the highlights with the Radio Lancashire commentary, and when Ipswich equalised, it was sort of silence. I mean, exactly what you want from local radio commentators. Almost wouldn't even know that the ball had gone in. It was great. And then when Burnley scored the winner, absolutely hammered the Ipswich players for time wasting. That'll learn you, or words to that effect.
There's an amazing quirk at the moment where when you've got loads of EFL fans watching games on iFollow, I think quite a few haven't worked out that if their team is away, you can change the commentary. But a lot of people haven't realised this. So a lot of away fans having to sit at home and watching games with the home team local commentary, and the amount of the Twitter discourse that comes out of this with the biased nature of the commentary is incredible.
And actually, there's a real I noticed this from watching all the Cambridge games during the pandemic and watching them now, is that local radio commentators, you know, they really thrived off the fact that no one could actually see the action. Yeah. And when you're watching it and you're going, no, we haven't been dominating this game. We really haven't, let's be honest. The best was during the pandemic where I think we were away to, Stevenage or something, and Three Counties Radio pressed the wrong button. And so we had like drive time on Three Counties, just playing Phil Collins while the game was going on. It was really entertaining. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, let's do the Championship. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, presuming you don't follow everything in the EFL, we'll keep it basic. Burnley are top of the Championship, 65 points from 29 games. Sheffield United have 58 from 29. It is incredibly tight below them. Middlesbrough in third, Luton in fourth, both on 48. Watford and West Brom make up the playoff places. You could go all the way down and possibly make a case for even, I don't know, Birmingham going on some wild run from 18th to make it. It is ludicrously tight in the Championship. We should talk first, George, about Burnley, who are sort of since game one of this season, which was a Friday night game, wasn't it? And everyone went, hang on, Burnley are playing different football. They've been sensational, haven't they?
Incredible. Yeah, I think on this podcast kind of referred to them as a bit similar to that first game that Leeds had under Bielsa, where you look at it and you're like, whoa, this is a bit different. And that's continued over the course of the season. You know, it's pretty rare that you have a team being so dominant in the Championship. You know, it's mid-February. They've won, I think, their 12 of their last 14 games. One of those defeats came in that bizarre 5-2 defeat against Sheffield United. And Sheffield United themselves have been dominant, but still find themselves 7 points behind Burnley. Burnley have a 17-point cushion to third at this stage. I mean, they are playing football in a way that suggests to me that Vincent Kompany is an elite coach, an elite manager. I see that with the rumours swirling around Pep Guardiola's future, Kompany is the second favourite to take over at Manchester City, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if that happened, because the way that Burnley look to play as well, it's not Guardiola football. It is very high intensity, it is very possession based, but there's also a big onus on getting flair players on the ball and letting them express themselves, whether that's Manuel Benson on the right hand side, who scored something like 9 league goals from an expected goals of about 2.5, just bending balls into the top left-hand corner from the right-hand channel at will. Anas Aruri on the left, Nathan Teller, who scored the 2 goals. You know, all of these really talented, technical, young players, and companies just breathed such confidence into them and enabled them to go and express themselves in a way that is so impressive. And you have other Championship fans who have brought up Burnley's wage bill and the fact that they have a big budget and that parachute payments help. And yes, you know, they sold £70 million worth of talent in the summer. You've still got players like Jack Cork and Ashley Barnes and Jay Rodriguez, who are playing big roles in this new style of football. But I think Kompany deserves credit for the way that he's managed to get his philosophy across, implement this really easy on the eye attacking style to such good effect. And he's played a big part in that recruitment as well, where they've gone to the Belgian league especially and recruited incredibly well. So it's one of the most impressive. I don't think it's a great quality addition, renewal of the Championship, but you know, they belong alongside Leeds, Daniel Farke's Norwich second time, and then last season's Fulham as the best Championship sides we've seen in recent years.
George, you talk about Vincent Kompany being Pep's heir apparent. Do you think he would fancy the step down to the Northern Premier League?
Yeah, it's a funny one where it would certainly raise eyebrows if he were to get the job after, you know, anytime soon at the top end of the Premier League. But you have to think that if City are hit with a 30-point deduction going into next season and Pep Guardiola walks out the door, then suddenly the big name managers they may have been linked with won't be too interested in it. And I'm sure that Kompany, given his affinity to the club, given his affinity to the fan base, and fully in the knowledge that once they ride out this storm, if there isn't going to be an expulsion from the Premier League, he's going to still be in one of the top jobs in football. I'm sure he would be. Burnley fans won't like me for saying it, but I would have thought he'd jump at the chance.
I was just going to say, I feel like we should give Connor Roberts his magnificent moustache a mention as well. I believe he's going to stick with it until Burnley lose, which so it could be a while yet. And Roberts, being the very sort of self-deprecating, modest character, he has said Burnley's recent run has been fairly decent. So, they're doing a great job there.
A lot of people will have only seen Sheffield United play these games against Wrexham, Ben, and go, well, hang on, how are they second in the Championship? But they have got they've got a bit of a cushion themselves. It seems unlikely. There's obviously still time that they'll get caught. How good are they?
Yeah, no, I think it will be Burnley and Sheffield United, sort of as dull as maybe that sounds or will be. Paul Heckingbottom has done a very good job, a different job to Vincent Kompany. But again, I suppose you can't ignore the sort of recent history, recent past at Sheffield United. That there's massive highs under Chris Wilder. Paul Heckingbottom probably not, you know, maybe seen as a bit underwhelming in some quarters as an appointment for a top Championship club, but I think he's done a superb job. I suppose it's hard to get too excited given there is a decent level of player at his disposal. You know, Sander Bird's still there. You know, still lots of players on, you know, reasonable money. And I think they are where you'd expect them to be, whereas perhaps Burnley, it's even more impressive because of the turnaround and the turnaround in not only players, but the turnover sort of style of play as well.
And crucially, they've got Ollie Norwood, who gets promoted in every single season that he plays in the Championship. So, no need for any analysis there.
It's a hack, isn't it? Michael Carrick is doing a great job at Middlesbrough, isn't he, George?
Incredible job. He came into a side who are massively underperforming. You can kind of lump them and West Brom into the same category, where you had two clubs who were expected to be right at the top end of the Championship, who had decent wage bills, who'd invested well in the summer. And with Chris Wilder and Steve Bruce in charge, you know, two experienced managers, regardless of what you think of the two of them, who've achieved promotion out of the Championship before. And both of them had terrible starts, but they were massive, massive data outliers, where all the expected goals tables, all the underlying numbers tables had them as top six clubs, when actually the fans were seeing something different and they were, you know, down towards the bottom end of the table. So for Corberan and Carrick, it felt like a good job for them to come into, where expectations were low, performance levels were fairly high, and the squad and the wage bills they had at their disposal were pretty high as well. But you can't deny that Carrick has done, you know, what he's done there in terms of galvanise a group of players. He's come into a club where I can't imagine he knew a great deal of the squad before. He's promoted a player called Hayden Hackney, who actually the caretaker boss before him brought into the side. A basically untried, untested central midfielder who's now a focal point of their side. Shifted Ryan Giles back from left wing to left back, where he's been a revelation this in the time since. Chuba Akpom now top scorer in the Championship, playing a number 10 role, having not scored that many goals before he came in. Just he seems to have that Midas touch, where everything he does seems to work. And yeah, I do think it will be Sheffield United who finished in second behind Burnley. But if there's a team who have the, you know, who will be breathing down their necks if their form does slide, you have to think it's going to be Borough.
Luton, Watford are fourth and fifth, which would be some playoff semi-final if it happened. Barry, who is the Watford manager?
Slaven Bilic.
Well, very good. I had to Google. Did you?
No, I just answered without...
Yeah, I know. But maybe you've done some research for this pod. I don't know. I was just thinking...
I do research for every that was my... pod. But, well, I know checking who the Watford manager wasn't part of my research. I know who it is. I mean, I wouldn't have been entirely surprised if you told me, no, he was sacked a month ago.
or this morning. It's a good point. They're plodding along... Nice. I mean, is fifth good, playoffs is good for Watford, is it, Ben? Or should they be pushing a bit higher?
I think given the sort of monstrosity of the start of the season they had, it would be okay. It would be acceptable. And I do think once they're in there, I think they're strong. I think the squad is strong. Bilic, you know, knows the league very well. And I think just because of the way the top two have pulled away, I think anything more is going to be nigh on impossible. So, yeah. I think given the start they've had, you'd have to take it. At the start of the season, I think they would have wanted to have been in those top two. But I think Bilic has done a pretty sound job, to be fair, since he's gone in there. And I really like him as well, so I'd like to see him do it.
Like I said, George, it's so tight below that. I mean, who of those sides in that, you think about it, you know, West Brom 44 points. You go down to Reading in 16th on 38, you know, just, what's that, 6 points behind. Like, it's incredibly tight. I don't know, out of those sides, who you think is more likely to sustain a realistic push for the playoffs?
I think there are some interesting ones in there. Norwich under David Wagner have looked a far better side with him there, despite the fact they were dispatched 3-0 at Carrow Road by Burnley last weekend. I think his arrival at the club will give them a bit of an identity that they've lacked earlier in the season under Dean Smith. It certainly galvanised the fans, and it wouldn't surprise me if they went on a little run. Sunderland have had a nightmare with injuries. Their top scorer, talisman Ross Stewart, was injured for quite a lot of the first half of the season. He's now out till the end of the season, somehow managing to score double figures of goals despite seemingly being injured for the whole campaign so far. Joe Gellhart has come in on loan from Leeds, who you think will be a very good signing, and they've got this brilliant array of attacking players, as I'm sure Barry will agree, and Jack Clark, Amad Diallo on loan for Manchester United, Patrick Roberts, Alex Pritchard. They're one of the funnest teams to watch, and in Tony Mowbray, they've got a manager who I think is pretty good at just enabling those players to go out and express themselves. The loss of Stewart is a massive blow. The loss of Ellis Sims, who's gone back to Everton after his loan spell, is a blow as well. You do kind of feel like if they hadn't had such difficult injuries up front, then Sunderland would probably be much closer to it. And then the kind of joker in the pack that no one seems to be talking about at the moment are Hull, who are in 12th at the moment with a negative 7 goal difference, but on 40 points and only, what, 4 points off the playoffs. The Shota Arveladze did not do a good job in his time at Hull. It felt like they invested pretty well in the summer and they just had a far better squad than a manager. They are perceived, I think, of not being one of the big hitters in the Championship, despite Ashin Ishalili, their Turkish Simon Cowell, as he's known, owner, you know, having certainly putting some money behind the club. And since Lima Senior's come in a few weeks ago, they've looked far, far better. Aaron Connolly, a really good addition up front. They've got Malcolm Ebiove on loan from Palace as well. They're in really good form. And I do think they could be the kind of side that are putting it all together at a good time to make a late run.
I have a question for you, Max.
Okay, here we go.
Who's the Wigan manager?
And hang on a second. It was Kolo Touré, wasn't it? Wasn't he sacked the other day?
Oh, he was, yes. I missed that.
Okay. So now who's the Wigan manager? I imagine it's Paul Jewell again. But, you know.
Sean Maloney, but I was expecting you to say Kolo Touré just because his sacking went completely
right
below my radar.
I feel like there's a nice segue from the Wigan chat because there's a great moment on Monday when Blackburn played Wigan in the highly, hotly anticipated Monday night football that is Blackburn-Wigan. And they panned to the crowd sky. It was a Sky game. And they showed Lee Camp sat in the stands. And they captioned him as Eduardo Barrizo, who's the Chile manager. And I just thought that is most definitely Lee Camp. Lee Camp. It was the first time I think I've seen Lee Camp since I saw him in a waterfront pretentious bar in Bournemouth. So great to see him again, but it was most definitely him and not the Chile manager. So,
but also he looks nothing like the Chile manager as well, like at all. Like he just looked quite Chilean with his nice long flowing locks sitting in the stand.
Was he there to run the rule over Ben Brereton Diaz?
How pretentious can a bar be in Bournemouth? I mean, I suppose it's...
Oh, very, very nice. Yeah.
It's quite nouveau riche, isn't it, as well? Be quite new money.
On Bournemouth Pier, yeah. Nice view, but very expensive.
Right, fair enough. And was, I mean, what was Lee Camp doing? Was he having a quiet drink or was he sort of knocking back the Jaegers?
No, it was a mid-afternoon, I believe. Must have been a post-training visit. I think there might... I don't want to sort of... what's the word? I don't want to...
Incriminate.
Or Charlie Daniels, who I believe was there with him. But
I saw Charlie Daniels in my local butcher about 2 months ago.
Oh, right. What was he getting?
He's getting around, isn't he? He was behind me.
Oh, right. Okay. So on a different podcast, Charlie Daniels is saying George Alec was picking up, you know,
yes,
a kilo of chops. I got a taxi once with Charlie Daniels. Well, at the end of the journey, this nice chap we chatted about football went, "Oh, I'm Charlie Daniels' dad." So there we are. It's the end of my Charlie Daniels anecdote. Anything to add on this, Barry, or want us to swiftly move on?
No, I've nothing in my Charlie Daniels.
So look, we're going to bottom level on points with Blackpool. Blackpool have a game in hand. Huddersfield a point above them. And then Cardiff and above them, Rotherham, Stoke, Birmingham, Bristol City. Ben, how would you survey the bottom three and who else might drop into that equation?
Very worried about Cardiff. I've seen them a couple of times live this season. I saw them against Leeds most recently, and obviously I know that's a cup game, but they've changed manager again. Mark Hudson was sacked. Steve Morrison, they sacked earlier in the season. Sabri Lamouchi's gone in, who was at Forest, and who I quite like, actually. I think he's quite an impressive appointment, especially considering where they are. Sol Bamba, obviously Cardiff legend, has gone in as assistant. So that on the face of it looks pretty good. But the reality is, the 16 games to go, they don't score many goals. The squad is just a total mishmash. They brought in nigh on 20 players last summer, I think 17. Lots of those haven't really worked or haven't done it. A couple have done okay. And they're just, they're what, 2 points above the bottom three. I'd be concerned about them. I just think as a club, it feels very stale. It feels very flat around the place. I don't know. I'd just be worried that what direction that's heading in. But I'd have to say, to caveat, I do think Lamouchi is a good get. It's just, I suppose it's all on him. I mean, he can't work miracles, but he's probably a better appointment than Morrison or Hudson, and maybe they lost a lot of time with respect to those guys in terms of what they could get out of the team.
It's been a shambles in terms of their recruitment in every facet. Steve Morrison was entrusted, and I'm not arguing that he shouldn't have been, but I feel like when you pick your pretty untested manager, he seemed to have quite a big say in recruitment in the summer, and then sacked him a couple of months into the season when they were quite far away from the relegation zone. You have to wonder what the strategy is if that's the way you're going to go about your business. I think Lamouchi is a pretty good get. They probably have enough quality in the squad to improve with a manager like him at the helm. But yeah, I mean, there are massive red flags in my mind about the way the clubs run.
All right, well, that'll do for the Championship. Part three, we'll do Leagues 1, League 2, and a bit of what's going on at Southend. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So League One looks like this. Sheffield Wednesday, Plymouth both have 61 points. Bit of a jump down to Ipswich in third on 55. Derby County, Bolton Wanderers, Barnsley make up the rest of the playoff picture with Peterborough, disappointingly. Wickham, Shrewsbury in contention. There's a bit of a gap down to Portsmouth. We'll talk about the bottom in a second. I'm nervous about it. But look, Wednesday, Darren Moore's done a great job, hasn't he, Ben? And Plymouth have done really well after, was it Ryan Lowe left and his assistant stayed on, and they're doing incredibly well too.
Yeah, Stephen Schumacher was sort of promoted to the top job at Plymouth. He's done brilliantly. Lost to Sheffield Wednesday last time out. As you say, Darren Moore doing just an incredible job at Sheffield Wednesday. Especially, you know, the club was viewed, and probably by many people listening, I think, hang on a minute, this Sheffield Wednesday were a bit of a basket case, and, you know, how's this happened? But they're top of the league, flying. Still have a game in hand on Plymouth. The attendances are incredible as well. I have to say that on Saturday against Plymouth, north of 33,000 at Hillsborough. You know, whether you're a Sheffield Wednesday fan or not, that's pretty powerful stuff. Look, you know, just brilliant for the EFL. And Darren Moore, as we know, is probably one of the nicest people in football. But great clip of him, very heartwarming clip of him clapping along to hi-ho Sheffield Wednesday pre-match and giving a little fist bump to a young mascot or fan, which is, you know, just brilliant. And but you know, aside from that and being a nice guy, he's doing a superb job. I remember going to Sheffield Wednesday derby, had to look, remind myself, can't believe it, it was May 2021 when Wednesday went down, mad game, 3-3 at Pride Park. Derby survived, Rooney was in charge that day, and Darren Moore hadn't been in at Wednesday very long at all. I remember after the game, him speaking, he was just so calm. And it was sort of the opposite of a demeanour of a guy whose team had just been relegated. And at the time, I'll be honest, I was a little bit sceptical. I thought, is he the right man to bring this club up? Obviously, a club with a lot of baggage back up. But fair play to him. He's done a, you know, superb job. There's a few survivors from both of the teams that day. Obviously, Barry Bannon still very much in a Sheffield Wednesday shirt. But yeah, Sheffield Wednesday and Derby. Since in those last sort of challenging couple of years, have done brilliantly.
I feel like Barry Bannon is too good for League One. A bit like Conor Hourihan, right, at Derby as well. That's like, doesn't seem like you should be. It's like when we had Wes Houlihan in League Two. Not really fair. It's like a ringer in Sunday League. Look, below Sheffield Wednesday and Plymouth, George, you've got Ipswich and Derby, both with interesting and good managers. I think Paul Warner's, you know, who came from Rotherham, has been so good. And is a brilliant bloke as well at Derby and Ipswich as well, although they were held by mighty Cambridge last time out.
It's a really weird one with Ipswich, where there's no denying that when you watch them play, you think this has to be the best team in the league. But you look at the league table and it tells a different story. They've had countless games this season where they've dominated the opposition and failed to make that into a win. There was one ridiculous game against Lincoln away where they... I think Lincoln completed 65 passes in the whole game. They had 10 men and it was a 1-1 draw. And Kieran McKenna, you know, I personally think he's a manager destined probably for the Premier League. But Ipswich fans understandably are saying, well, hold on, we've got the best squad supposedly in the league. Does it matter if we're, you know, if we look good on the eye, if we're not going to get promoted automatically? Now, the big thing in this League One promotion race is that although you've got, you know, the top two looking like they're clear, Plymouth Argyle have lost their keeper, Mike Cooper, who ruptured his ACL in the game against Sheffield Wednesday on Saturday. Now, I think he's probably the most important individual player to one team in the whole of the EFL. He's a Premier League goalkeeper playing for Plymouth Argyle. If you look at all the shot data, all the...
Why is he playing for them?
He's a product of their youth academy who will soon...
Right, okay.
And he is... if you look at all the data, like, you know, Argyle's XG against is towards the bottom of League One. And he, you know, if you look at the shot-stopping stuff, comes out on top by absolute miles. So without... the player that, you know, Schumacher after the game said, our best player, our keeper, is out. And it's not too often, I think, you'll find managers saying that their best player is their keeper, especially teams who are at the top end of a league. So that, I think, could open things up quite a lot. With Ipswich hosting Wednesday on Saturday in a massive game, I think both Ipswich and Sheffield Wednesday will be happy that even though they went out of the FA Cup, they avoided extra time last night. And then Derby are the ones who you have to think that if Paul Warne had been there since the start of the season, they'd probably be in that mix up at the top as well, because they are relentless. And David McGoldrick, who hadn't scored a career hat-trick up until this season, now has three in his last 13 games, age 35.
Wow, that's a great stat, isn't it? I just remember him just missing bagfuls of chances for Sheffield United. So good to see he's scoring goals. At the bottom, Forest Green, Duncan Ferguson at Forest Green, Barry, it's great, isn't it? I mean, he's got such a job on his hands.
Yeah, and I think everyone is interested to see how he'll get on. I think most people would like to see him do well, but he's got off to a bad start. I'm not sure how they lost. They were a goal up in his first game in charge and conceded two very late goals to lose. And they've lost at least one since, as far as I know. So I think he still has to get a win under his belt. But I'm curious to see how he gets on.
Barry, did you see the interview with him when he first joined?
I've seen a couple of interviews with him. There was quite an awkward exchange, something to do with vegan burgers and the environment in general. So, but he seems to be on board, on message anyway.
I think are chips vegan is one of the great questions that he asked during that. And also, the world is heating up was his response to whether or not he's aware of what's going on at the in terms of the environmental element of Del Vince's ownership.
You can't argue with it, can you?
No. Factually correct.
There are other strikers of his vintage who might not necessarily agree with him.
You're probably right. Or at least sort of number 10s. You're absolutely right. So look, Forest Green are on 21 points from 30 games. Second bottom are Cambridge United, 26 points from 28. Accrington, 26 points from 27. Should be 25 after last night against Port Vale, where... quite ridiculous, actually. George, you posted this in the group, didn't you? That Port Vale got a penalty. Like, Port Vale basically scored. But there was a handball about half a second before the ball was in the net. And the ref somehow managed to give a penalty and a straight red. And they missed the penalty. And that, when you're down at the bottom, when you're another team down at the bottom, is annoying.
I think, the best way to kind of describe, for those who haven't seen it, is it's Asamoah Gyan and Luis Suarez, apart from the fact that a Ghana player would have headed the ball over the line, but it was the goal was then disallowed and they missed the penalty as Gyan did. In my mind, I was thinking about this morning walking in, like, surely that should be a goal and a red card, do you not think? Because, you know, even if he's done the, you know, if you go in and clatter someone with a leg breaker and then someone rolls the ball in afterwards, just because they've scored from that phase of play doesn't take away from the fact that it's the offence is there. I mean, we need a referee on here. Where's Dermot Gallagher? But
where's Peter Walton to just agree with all of us? You're right. Anyway, look, it's really important. Every point matters at the bottom. You've got Cambridge, Accrington, Morecambe. I was reading about Morecambe's ownership. It is really confusing. I don't know, Ben, if you can... I mean, you can't surmise that in a minute, but do your best.
No, I mean, but there's a 20-year-old who is thought to be very close to a takeover. Since then, in the last couple of weeks, there's more and more question marks have been raised about him in the sort of legitimacy of where his money's come from. And he's not the only one. There's a couple of clubs at the moment where, same probably should have said at Sheffield United, where it's very hard to see a sort of footprint. In Sheffield United's case, it's supposedly sort of a billionaire airline owner. There's literally no sort of online footprint or carbon footprint or evidence of his business. And it's kind of the same at Morecambe, where there's a 20-year-old who a couple of weeks ago I was led to believe was very, very close to wrapping up a deal for the club. And I think there's still a strong chance of it happening, but I think the EFL have their hands full with various ownership issues, and even at Birmingham there's still an investigation into what's going on there. So there's lots of clubs in the EFL at the moment where fans are concerned about their clubs, and rightly so.
Let's quickly wrap off League Two. Leighton Orient are top on 60 points. Stevenage have 56. Carlisle in the other automatic promotion spot, with Northampton, Salford, Mansfield, Stockport making up the playoff places. Incredibly tight. You could go all the way down to 15th and Doncaster for the playoffs. At the bottom, Rochdale are below Gillingham with Hartlepool, Crawley and Harrogate, maybe Newport in trouble. Is League Two, Ben, going as, you know, is anyone a total shock? It seems surprising to me that Stevenage are doing that well from the last time I was watching League Two.
Yeah, I mean, well, Steve Evans is a sort of manager of the season territory for what he's done at Stevenage in the turnaround. Obviously, they had that great win at Aston Villa a few weeks ago in the Cup. It's kind of cherry on the cake of a just superb season. I mean, lifted them away from trouble last year and they're well on course for automatic promotion this. Carlisle, a very good story in their own right as well, I think. Paul Simpson, a couple of years ago, had to have some time out from the game while he was at Bristol City as an assistant coach. Had kidney cancer. I believe he's from the area in Carlisle. He's gone back there, played for the club. And again, a bit like Steve Evans, he lifted them away from trouble last year, ensured they stayed up. I think they finished 19th, 20th. And they are, what, third in the division, won the last four. So, yeah, they're in a really good place. Orient, at the top of the league under Richie Wellens, had hints of a wobble, I suppose, of late. But I think he's a really good manager, sort of proving himself again, knows the division well. Hasn't always worked for him at previous clubs, but he's got them heading in the right direction. And I suppose, to answer your question, the top seven is probably clubs you'd expect to be there. Bradford just outside. Maybe people expected a little bit more from Stockport. Spent a lot of money, very ambitious after coming up. But generally, I would say it's as you would expect.
George, go with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult to with League Two. It is a proper league where, you know, you can get clubs like Barrow, who were favourites to finish bottom, ending up being in pretty comfortably in the top half. Stevenage, another one like that. I would say that there's always this idea where, because clubs coming out of the National League have been able to spend bigger due to the lack of financial constraints, certainly in previous seasons. It was the same as Salford. It's the same as Stockport this season. I think people maybe just miss... There's a miss representation of the gap in quality between the top end of League Two, certainly, than the top end of the National League. Although no club has ever been relegated in their first season back in the EFL, haven't been promoted from the National League, which is quite something. But yeah, I mean, it's still very tight in that top seven. There are still, as you say, 15 teams that could finish in it.
Let's talk about Southend United, relegated from the Football League in 2021, currently sixth in the National League, doing okay on the pitch, all isn't well off it. James Schooley is from the Save Our Southend campaign. James, thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You've had to start a Save Our Southend campaign, which indicates things are not going well. Why have you had to start it?
I mean, we kicked off back in 2021, I think, as far as I can remember. I don't know if you guys had your ears to the ground with it, but at the time that Phil Brown was sacked for the second time after a 4-0 defeat at home to Chesterfield, that was when things really kind of ramped up for us, as we were sitting precariously just above the relegation zone in the National League. And obviously at that point, you're talking about potentially three consecutive relegations from League One down to National League South. You know, pretty bad atmosphere at that point. But yeah, we've kind of carried on since then and finding that we need to be pushing alongside the Shrimpers Trust at the minute for new ownership eventually.
Right. Your chairman is Ron Martin. Apparently, he's got until March the 1st to make a payment to the HMRC of £1.4 million, according to reports in the Mail, which is an extraordinary amount of money for a team in the National League. What is, you know, who is Ron Martin and how would you say he has been as a chairman?
Oh, how long have you got? Ron Martin is an Essex-based property developer. Now, he came into the club in 98. He has a 50% holding in a company called Southeastern Leisure, which took over the club, 70% of its shares in the late 90s. I remember the first plans for a new stadium under Ron Martin being published around 2000. And here we are, obviously, 22, 23 years later. And in some respects, we feel no closer to it actually happening. Now, Ron, I think, admitted that when he first came to the club, he didn't particularly like football. He says fallen in love with the game since then and fallen in love with the club. However, many of us still believe that despite him having an affection for the club, we are still a vehicle for his property development dreams and the big wad of cash that he's going to make eventually.
Southend have faced winding up offers in the recent past. Ron Martin has met all those payments. The Southend Echo confirmed last week office staff members still waiting to be paid for December and January Something that your chief executive, Tom Lawrence, confirmed, saying that we're working hard to resolve it. We're grateful to our staff for their patience. We believe we're close to being able to remedy the position. Also confirmed the club has fallen behind on a payment plan to St John's Ambulance. We've fallen behind on a payment plan for that. We're communicating with them. We hope to be able to get back on track. St John's will be providing cover for the next match. I mean, how nervous are you that Southend might cease to exist very soon?
More nervous, I think, than I've ever been. We know that he has managed to pay these bills off in the past. And to a certain extent, I think he has to, because he's not one of those owners, I don't believe, many of us don't believe, who, you know, is taking money out of the club, who's looking to cause it to cease to exist. But he has tied it up so much in his own future success off the back of the property development that he needs us, I think. You know, we owe money all over the place, HMRC, players and staff. You mentioned St John's Ambulance. There's various suppliers who supply catering to the Roots Hall on Saturday that we haven't paid either. So, you know, the fan experience is going down the drain. Roots Hall is literally falling to pieces. I mean, it's verging on being a health and safety hazard now. So it's kind of been backed into a corner where we need to move to the new stadium as well before the place falls down. So he released a statement. I don't know if any of you read it, but the most recent statement that he released from the club said that he hoped to get the bridging finance in place to pay the HMRC debt, but he couldn't give a timescale as to when that money would arrive in the club. So that obviously has everyone panicking that it's not going to arrive in time for this hearing that's marked as final on the 1st of March. And, you know, if we don't pay that money, we face the real prospect of being wound up.
Whenever we talk to, you know, and we've talked about Macclesfield and Bury, and like fans of every other club think, oh, well, it's not, you know, your first thought is it's not us, you know, like for lower league fans, for smaller clubs. And it's hard to articulate quite what a football club means to a town like Southend, does it? You know, I mean, like it's, I don't know. You can probably say it better than I do, but it feels like that's a really crucial part of this place.
It is, absolutely. It's, you know, it's a pillar of the local community. It's, you know, it does some excellent things in the community with local kids, with those with additional needs. So in that aspect, it's an important part of the community. It's been here for well over 100 years, and it feels sometimes like Mr. Martin tramples all over that. And it feels as well to me that, especially with all of the mispayments to various suppliers and whatnot, that the club's standing and reputation, both in football and in the business world, is just as far in the gutter as it could be at the minute. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, obviously our concentration at the minute, of course, is on hopefully getting through the end of the month, fingers crossed. But after that, the pressure needs to stay up to at least get an exit plan and a timetable, as it were, from Ron Martin, because I think he believes that the new stadium is the light at the end of the tunnel. It'll all be hunky-dory once we're in there. The light at the end of the tunnel to us is that and him being gone. I don't think he can redeem himself here. He probably thinks he can, but he's damaged the club to the extent now that we need a fresh start badly. So, you know, that's a long-term aim.
Do you have any dialogue with him?
At the moment, no. He has very much gone into hiding. He doesn't come to games at the minute. He defers everything to Tom Lawrence, the CEO, who's done a remarkable job, by the way, to, yes, people are going unpaid, but the balancing he's doing is at least stopping games from being postponed as things stand. But it's difficult to get any dialogue with him. He's taken a step back. He's very... You know, back in the days where we had a bit of success, obviously with him, he was very happy to walk around the pitch and lap up the applause of the fans. But when things get a bit tough, he's gone hiding. We are trying to post some questions to him, but it's very difficult to kind of pin him down at the minute.
Listen, James, good luck with it. I think every football fan, wherever they are, will agree with that, you know, it is vital that our football clubs stay in business, and it is always depressing when we hear one might be on the brink. So look, good luck, and we will keep in touch for sure. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, guys. Much appreciated.
James Schooley there from the Save Our Southend campaign. Ron Martin's most recent statement, by the way, says, "I remain committed to delivering the bridging finance which will fit the funding gap caused by successive relegations and loss of income during the pandemic. The money owed to HMRC is a legacy debt accrued during the period of the pandemic. Those bridging funds will in part be applied against the HMRC debt with a view to withdrawing the petition. Whilst I'm not currently able to outline precise timings, I am conscious of the fans' concerns and will look to provide a further update as soon as is practical. All right, that'll do for today's pod. Just one question from Tom. Who would win in a fight, one Subaru-sized Trevor Nelson or 100 Trevor Nelson-sized Subarus? Thank you. Appreciate those and all your sympathy for my missing car. But for the time being, thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, George.
Thank you.
Cheers, Barry.
Thanks.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.